Good evening. Welcome to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Wednesday. Support for WEAA is provided by ADT. More information available at ADT.com. Coming up in the second hour of the show on this Wellness Wednesday, Kenyatta Moon is here. She's the founder of the Interim Academy for Holistic Thought, co-host of Holistic Living, this week talking about holistic education, practicing peace for children in the classroom and at home, as we look forward to the event coming up, Helping Our Children Be Our Best, coming up next month. We'll begin a series of conversations leading up to that workshop event that is being sponsored by the Interim Academy for Holistic Thought. Also in the second hour, Lamont Summers will be here. He's assistant professor of media, law, and ethics here at the School of Global Journalism and Communication. He will have the media report a little bit later in this first hour. The Mod Squad will be here. That's Stephen Janis and Tara Graham of the Real News Network talking about politics and law enforcement, including thoughts on Mayor Pugh's crime plan, newly released crime plan, and her selection for criminal justice director. That's coming up a little bit later in this first hour. But first, the continued rhetoric or the continued sparring, at least verbal sparring, between the United States and North Korea connected to nuclear weapons, which makes it a very dangerous scenario indeed. To talk about that, we bring on the best person to talk about that, and that is Dr. Tyrone Powers. He is a national security expert and director of the Homeland Security Criminal Justice Institute of Anne Arundel Community College. Dr. Powers, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Good to be with you as always, Sean. You do an excellent job.
Oh, bless you. I appreciate you, Dr. Powers, very much. Before we get started, let me remind our listeners to make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I'll share it with the people unless you don't want me to. And, of course, I won't do it. Now, back to Dr. Powers, national security expert and director of the Homeland Security Criminal Justice Institute of Anne Arundel Community College, former FBI agent. Dr. Powers, first of all, let's just go, the 45th president, in a tweet, I believe, said, in response to provocations, nuclear provocations by North Korea, he said, let me find the quote, but I know the quote included fire and fury, and that phrase alone caused quite a reaction from leaders all around the world, including New Zealand and Australia. So the question is, Donald Trump using fire and fury in reaction to threats by North Korea, which is not a new phenomenon. North Korea has been making nuclear threats upon the United States for many years. But obviously, the 45th president seems to be ratcheting up the rhetoric. What implications does that type of talk have for national security interest in the United States and around, and security interest not just domestically but around the globe?
Yeah, this is kind of a unique situation. First of all, let me kind of explain something, that North Korea's testing of nuclear weapons and identification of nuclear weapons is twofold. They've been doing it for years, for one thing. Secondly, after the invasion of Iraq for a search for weapons of mass destruction, and after the willful surrender of nuclear technology by Muammar Gaddafi and by the South African government during the time Nelson Mandela headed it, the philosophy was that countries that willingly gave up their pursuit of nuclear power would then not become the subject of any military action of the United States or any Western powers. Well, to an extent, their nations, in their view and from their perception, has been betrayed. In other words, Gaddafi willingly gave up his, and then with the assistance of the United States, he was eliminated with prejudice. Saddam Hussein was pulled out a hole in his country. So the philosophy was that if we demonstrate that we go into these particular nations, that we use military might, then other leaders would be deterred from getting nuclear weapons and certainly would be deterred from any rhetoric towards the United States. But unfortunately, and the intelligence community analyzed this thoroughly, it actually had the opposite effect. Nations began to decide that the only way they could avoid military action by the United States and Western powers against them was to have nuclear capability, and not only have nuclear capability, but display nuclear capability as a warning that if you attempt to invade us, even if we cannot successfully hit the continental United States, we will cause so much destruction that other nations will become angry with you. So it had the opposite effect. Remember, if you recall, George W. Bush called it shock and awe in Iraq, and he thought that would scare other nations. You would be in so much shock and awe, you would do whatever we say. But it's had the opposite effect in countries like Iran, certainly in countries like North Korea, and certainly other countries around the world that are pursuing nuclear weapons are testing them, like India and Pakistan, who have nuclear capability right. and certainly not going to give them up. So when President Trump uses the rhetoric, what it does is instead of putting these nations in fear, and certainly putting nations like North Korea in fear, it verifies for them their need to increase their nuclear weapon capability and their demonstration of their ability to wreak havoc, not necessarily on the continental United States, because they believe that the other option of actually standing down led to the demise of Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein.
The specific quote or the specific tweet that the 45th president used was, "North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen." First of all, I mean, Dr. Powers, I mean, even if you were to sort of remove that type of language from the scenario in which it's meant, it just seems incredibly unpresidential just on its face. I mean, what, regardless of what type of scenario it is, it seems, the way it sounds, the language, the tone is not presidential. And in some ways, it almost seems like, despite the menacing language, it's almost like you can't take the 45th president serious, even though he is the president of the United States, and I would argue you should take him seriously.
Yeah, well, what it does, two things. I think one of the peripheral effects that it has is that nations such as Russia, nations such as China, are suggesting that you are suggesting that you have the ability to create an explosion, an attack that the world. So your military might is unprecedented and unmatched. And even to them, in a sideways way, because when the president makes a statement, he's not only talking to the nation that he's directing the comment to.
Correct.
He's talking to other nations about our capability, and more importantly, the willingness to use this kind of technology. Most nations refrain from Russia. Refrain from this. They have a tremendous nuclear capability. They've launched new subs in the last few years that are stealth subs with nuclear capability, but they refrain from the language of this. It's very seldom that you have the head of a nation, and certainly the head of a superpower, using this kind of incendiary language, right. because, again, history dictates that it demonstrates that it actually had other nations prepare. Any intelligence, counterterrorism, counterintelligence community, and all the agencies, This is a disaster, because now what they have to do is monitor it, and on your show, Sean, you do a great job here, but it's not just you speaking about this today. Once that comment was made, the intelligence agencies, the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, then begin to monitor the reaction, not just of North Korea. They begin to monitor the reaction of China. They begin to monitor the reaction of Russia. They begin to monitor the reaction of India and Pakistan and other nations that have nuclear capability. Again, we all know whether we are, you know, you're not allowed to, the government, our government is not allowed to admit that Israel had nuclear weapons. It's an agreement that we signed under the Nixon administration that they could have nuclear weapons. As long as they didn't mention them, we didn't mention them, and they didn't test them, so we test them for Israel. So Israel doesn't mention the fact that they have nuclear weapons or their nuclear capability, even though via this agreement we know that it exists. However, nations, certainly nations such as the United States, don't use that language, and it causes a reaction. It causes every intelligence agency in the United States to now monitor the reaction of others. Did the Russians, even though it was a threat towards North Korea, did the Russians begin to put their submarines on alert? We got to monitor that now, even though it's a threat to North Korea, because you can't hit North Korea geographically without damaging China. You can't fire a nuclear weapon in North Korea without radiation infecting China. What impact did it have on the Chinese military, on their maneuvers, on their alert status? So all that, based on a comment from a president, an ill-advised comment, which you'll seldom hear any president make. Even think about this, Sean, and you'll remember this. Even during the time of the presidency of Ronald Reagan, when the Ronald Reagan accused Libya of blowing up a discotheque in Germany, which later found out wasn't true, he kept his language pretty quiet. He did use a flight to go and attack Libya, ended up killing his son, but his language was very different. He said, "We spoke to Libya tonight in the only language they understand." That was the extent of it. Not shock and awe, not will the world had never seen what we did. And then that was the extent in the end of his presentation, because we those people understand that when you make those comments, it's not only for North Korea, but everyone else says the United States have nuclear weapons. And the president of the United States has just indicated not only that they have them, but that they're willing to use them.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yost, your host, talking to Dr. Tyrone Powers. He is a national intelligence expert, director of the Homeland Security Criminal Justice Institute of Anne Arundel Community College, talking about the provocation of North Korea, nuclear provocation, at least verbal provocation, by the North Korean leader. And in return, Donald Trump said, quote, "North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen." That type of rhetoric, Dr. Powers, as you have been obviously alluding to, first of all, it strikes me as being political because the president is flailing as far as the polling is concerned back at here in the United States. His support of his base is actually eroding. His approval rating continues to hover in the 30% range, and so I would argue that this president is attempting to, just put it plainly, look tough and somehow appease his base, even though it seems maybe to even be having the opposite effect, along with destabilizing relations with other nations around the world.
Well, two things here. Politics aside, and politics certainly irrelevant, because we know that the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower talked about, that when in times of instability or could be low presidential ratings, that any kind of a conflict that galvanizes the country and brings them together has kind of distraction from any political going that is happening, but this is different than anything. I think that he probably did have a conversation with his national security advisors afterwards, because this is different to threaten nuclear war. Now, again, we all know that the North Koreans have been trying to develop a nuclear weapon, and to be quite frank with you, Sean, from an intelligence standpoint, they've been trying to develop that for years. I know that from working counterterrorism and counterintelligence, and they're not going to stop, because they truly believe that is their only defense against a U.S. invasion from South Korea. We may put the Korean War in our rearview mirror, but they truly believe that the U.S. is intending, whether that's true or not, whether it's just paranoia, to attack, and they believe that their only defense is to demonstrate their nuclear capability. Now, the thing is, though, historically, North Korea, along with some other nations who've done some rattling, have always been rational enough to understand that they can't win that kind of conflict, and it doesn't benefit them to engage in that kind of conflict. What it does is it benefits them to demonstrate that they have that power. But countries like the United States don't usually do that. And so, again, the significance of this politically, but beyond politics, is what it did to the alert systems around the world, because from China to everyone else. And I think that it's a unique situation. And probably I suspect that there were people that had a conversation with President Trump after he made those comments about the significance and the results and the cost, how much it cost us militarily to be on alert, because other people got on alert even though they indicated they were not increasing their alert status. In fact, in Guam, they tried to calm it back down by saying we're not increasing our alert status based on what the president said, based on what North Korea said about their ability to attack Guam. So now is the time to calm it down. But the key is, can you do that with President Trump? Does he truly understand the significance of his words being the commander-in-chief of the most militarily powerful nation in the world? Does he really understand the chain reaction of those kind of statements when he make them, not only on the targeted ears and targeted countries, but on the rest of the world? And it could be quite a dangerous situation, besides being very costly and besides being very strenuous and stressful for the intelligence agencies, even of this country, what they have to prepare for.
It doesn't seem he does understand. But let me ask you this, Dr. Powers. North Korea, Pyongyang, has said that it would carry out a preemptive military strike against the U.S. You mentioned Guam, the specific Pacific territory of Guam, U.S. territory of Guam. Does from your knowledge base, does North Korea have the capacity to do what it says, launch a preemptive military strike against a U.S. territory, whether it be Guam or somewhere else?
Yeah, they're working towards having that ability. Their biggest thing was to have a device that could carry nuclear warheads a distance that could impact directly the United States, because let's face it, if you look at this historically, what North Korea have always tried to do was to threaten to get the countries to the negotiating table, and during the course of that negotiation to have sanctions removed, to have food brought into their country, because they're a very poor country. And so it's always been the threat of nuclear or military action have always been a negotiating tool they use to get countries that have resources to the table to share those resources or to give those resources to North Korea. And this leader of North Korea have actually stepped up the rhetoric in terms of demonstrating that he has the ability, because he believed that his statements in the past have not gotten anyone to the negotiating tables. And then he thinks that a demonstration of his might maybe get him to the table. But it's interesting that it comes on the heel of those nations meeting in China and Russia agreeing to impose sanctions against North Korea. So the sanctions were already agreed upon, and usually, and by two nations that usually didn't go along with those sanctions, Russia and China. And then for President Trump to say this on the heels of that is just disastrous, even for all the negotiations it took and all the diplomacy it took to even get Russia and China to decide to agree to take more drastic action against North Korea, and then for President Trump to come behind them with this. I think it's going to set us back tremendously in that area. North Korea has, you know, they're developing that capability, I think, more as a threat than a reality, because they are clear. And despite us saying that they're irrational, and I always argue this, I always make people clear of this, there's a lot of countries that have nuclear capability now, but there's only one country that's ever used an atom bomb, and that's the United States of America.
True.
So despite all the threat that these countries are making, they have been very rational in their deeds, even if they haven't been rational in their words.
Understood. Let's take a phone call real quick, Dr. Powers. Oscar in Baltimore wants to get into the conversation. Oscar, you're on with Tyrone Powers. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. I don't know if you guys heard it or not, but I think the Secretary of Defense for the United States made a statement worse than Trump's. He told North Korea that they will make regime change and destroy your people. Now, there's been a whole generation when Russia and the United States was been at each other's throat in the old Soviet Union. The United States got 20,000 nuclear weapons. Russia has 30,000. Never had the United States, any president or secretary of defense, threatened to destroy the Russian people. They said we got a deterrent factor, but they never threatened to destroy the Russian people. in World War II, 50 million people was killed. Hitler supposedly did all this horrible stuff. They never threatened to destroy the German people. But we know they had dropped an atomic bomb on Japan. Now they're just threatening to destroy the North Korean people. That is absolutely terrible. What it tells me that the United States and white people, will any country that is of color, they are willing to destroy them. They are saying we don't have a problem with France, Germany, Israel, any other white country having nuclear weapons, but we don't want Iran, Korea. They said the same thing about China. They just call them Red China until Chinese got nuclear weapons, and now they know they can't do a thing with China. And they're not going to, like Dr. Powell said earlier, they're not going to fire a nuclear weapon at North Korea with the chance of destroying some Chinese people. And they tell me we're the most powerful country in the world. If you got you got four or five operable nuclear weapons, then everybody's good as everybody. Because if they drop a nuke, all they have to do is take out New York or California.
Right.
So what the United States going to do about that?
Oscar, thank you for your comment. Dr. Powers, I mean, he speaks to the point that there's inflammatory rhetoric, not just coming from Donald Trump, but members of his cabinet as well.
Yeah, like I said, it's a unique situation, usually coming from an advanced nation, because the philosophy is that everyone knows that the United States of America is a nuclear power, like they know Russia is a nuclear power, and they don't necessarily do a lot of saber rattling because people know that. The whole concept, though, and I'll have to say this again, because India and Pakistan not only have nuclear weapons, the unique thing with Pakistan is they've allowed the U.S. to be in control of their nuclear weapons, where India have not allowed that kind of access. So that's why we always have this thing with Pakistan and Afghanistan, and whether the Pakistan is helping the Taliban, there's not much we can say, because that's a unique situation when a nation allows you to control their nuclear arsenal. But the fact of the matter is, nations believe in the concept of MAD. That's been since the Cold War. MAD simply means mutually assured destruction.
Right.
If I have nuclear weapons, there's nothing you can do to me militarily. Everything you do to me has to be at the negotiating table. We have to discuss things. We can yell at each other, but we can never go to war with each other because it advises mutually assured destruction. North Korea wants to be and is determined to be and is determined to send the message that they are part of that MAD concept with Pakistan, India, China, Russia, Israel. And Iran is saying the same thing quietly. They're doing no saber rattling, but they're saying you can, despite us signing the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Israel did not sign on to, they are simply saying that we will not be left without the ability to deter a military action against us, which was the case with Libya and Iraq. And again, we thought that by saying shock and awe, that it would scare them into not getting nuclear weapons.
Right.
But these countries said that we refuse to be defenseless. And I think that's what's happening in North Korea. This language from the United States, though, Sean, you are absolutely correct. I'm glad you brought it up. I think this is historically important to us because any large-scale war ends up sending a lot of African-American people into danger zones. And to be quite frank with you, most of them don't come back home.
Dr. Tyrone,
exactly
true. Dr. Tyrone Powers is a national security expert. He's director of the Homeland Security Criminal Justice Institute of Anne Arundel Community College. Dr. Powers, it's always a pleasure, man. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for the opportunity. Have a great evening.
You too. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the Mod Squad will be here. That's Taya Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network talking about politics and law enforcement, including Mayor Catherine Pugh's newly released crime plan, as well as her pick for a criminal justice director. Welcome back to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. Sean Yo is your host, making the transition from the perilous machinations of 45th President of the United States to the work of the Mod Squad. That is Taya Graham and Stephen Janis. They are the from the Real News Network. They are the Mod Squad from the Real News Network.
If only the president was so eloquent, you know, maybe we wouldn't be in this perilous machinations instead of fire like you've never seen.
Fire and
we don't want to go into that bleeding that segment, but nevertheless, I wish he spoke that way about this instead of.
I wish he knew the definition of the word perilous.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
That's Tag Ramley.
Wow.
Pardon me.
Yeah, she's always dropping bombs.
Welcome, friends.
No,
good
no
to see you.
No pun intended.
It's great to see you, Sean.
Good to see you.
So we have a lot to get to.
Yeah. Finally, a crime plan.
Have you gotten a look at it?
Well, Tay and I were reading it furiously.
yes, doing our best.
You know, I mean, I guess at first, you know, obviously, just to give people background, there's been a lot of controversy because people have been criticizing, specifically Councilman Brandon Scott, has been criticizing the mayor in preparation for his mayoral run, I believe. Well,
speaking
let's be honest.
Of dropping bombs.
Yeah, exactly. The council released their own plan, Live to Be More. But now the mayor has released her plan, sort of a dueling plan, which is sort of a regular occurrence around City Hall where people, when things get bad, people start talking about plans, like, what's your plan? As if there was some person that could sit in a back room and type something up and that would just change all the dynamics of Baltimore City. But nevertheless, the mayor released her plan, which Taya and I reviewed.
Yes.
And the first thing I think that people should note is that the first 20 or so pages are dedicated entirely to the police department, which is... Of course,
and that is true.
Telling.
Yes, they do make some interesting proposals. For example, the idea of a stabilization center.
Yeah, I like that.
And I did like that idea that it would be a place where someone who is found publicly intoxicated, displaying some form of intoxication and needing perhaps mental health services as opposed to incarceration, and that's supposed to be open 24 hours a day, seven days a week. And I saw a picture of where where it is proposed to be built. And it looks like a good spot. And so I think that's a healthy alternative, a good diversionary method to perhaps keep people out of our criminal justice system that don't need to be there, as well as get them the mental health services that they need.
But a lot of it was focused on, you know, police structure, you know, police being, I guess, the best thing, improving relationships with the police department and the community, police recruitment, that they're recruiting new officers and training them better. Focus
making sure
on guns.
That technology too. Technology was a big
all
point.
All the neoliberal euphemisms for, hey, I got a copywriter. He's pretty good. But sorry, Sean.
Sorry.
I just gave me that glare. But anyway, and also as I sent to you something that really irked me because of an article we wrote in the Afro.
You sent me a note, and right, this week your story talked about the department covertly in ways relying on statistics to as a metric for officers' performance.
But going back, we did a story on the homicide clearance rate, and this there was a thing in this report saying, oh, the homicide clearance rate is 57% this year, which is exactly what we tried to inform people about, was that the homicide clearance rate isn't applicable to only this year's cases. So they feature in the report it being 57%, but as anyone who reads the Afro should know, being an informed resident of Baltimore, which I highly recommend you pick it up, it has...
Me too. I second that.
Should know that the clearance rate this year is actually more around 30 to 29%. But anyway, that was one
So in So within a crime plan, they're touting the clearance rate as being...
Mm-hmm. Yes, a sign that they are making progress.
What percent?
They were saying it's 57%,
That's outrageous.
That's outrageous because it's not true, which was the point we were trying to make in the story, that people have to be buyer beware, that actually that includes, at the last count, 50 or 60 cases from years past, which aren't even cases that have led to arrests. Some of them are just people that were shot and they consider them to be suspects. But anyway, so that was a big part of the crime plan. But, you know, and then they said they would increase the number of summer jobs for youth, increase after school program. They did say they were going to invest in recreation centers, expanding recreation centers, right, or try to rebuild.
Yeah,
but there wasn't specific how much money. Go ahead.
And they also mentioned that they had made an improvement from turning around the amount, the time that it takes to process DNA evidence. So from it being 160 days
to really
60 days. Yes, I actually did do my homework. And that sort of struck me as odd because I think we know about that, the recent case of Mr. Humbert, who's a homeless man who lived in Charles Village, who was accused of rape. Mm-hmm. And he sat in jail for 14 months as it was known that Baltimore City Police did have DNA evidence that exonerated him, as well as the witness was unable to identify him as the assailant. So in the case of them saying DNA evidence has now gone from 160 days to 60 days, tell that to Mr. Humbert, who spent 14 months in jail awaiting the DNA evidence that proved his innocence.
just a bottom line.
He was just awarded $2.3 million because of that, by the way.
That's a great point to add. Just the bottom line of the report, I mean, it is really police heavy. And it does seem to feel like if we just tweak this police machine that we've been running for like 40, 50, 60 years, that machine will suddenly, if it starts working efficiently, suddenly the city is going to be.
Now we got it together. Now, finally, okay, this is it. This is what we needed.
Yeah, we need a little more of this and a little more of that, and then it's going to run smooth.
But so. honestly, and this is connected to a recurring theme that we've talked about on this segment about the majority of the men and women of the Baltimore Police Department. When they go just rattle back and forth and lurch to and fro and change policies and force policies that have historically not worked, this is not just impactful negatively to the residents of Baltimore. It has a negative impact on the rank and file.
Yeah, sure.
Because they're the ones who have to carry out these crazy orders.
Yeah.
And do what they're told and probably with the knowledge inside of themselves that this isn't working and this isn't helping me do my job.
That's a really good point. I mean, I'm sure that they're saying to themselves, you know, we can't fix these problems. Police aren't really equipped to fix these problems. This isn't really what police are about. But if you look at the first 20, 30, there's a lot of tasks like, you know, dealing with mental illness and things that the police department is expected to participate in, which is, you're right. You're almost like saying, setting them up to fail. You know they can't fix this.
Right.
They know they can't. Everyone in the community knows they can't. But it seems like that's where they start. And partially that's just because that's where all the money is.
You know, they're keeping the war room, by the way. They're going to have biweekly war room meetings at police headquarters centered around trigger pullers and violent offenders. So for anyone out there who was worried that the war room was going to disappear, feel assured.
It was concerned. It was going to shut down. And they will be having tours of the war room and a souvenir shop right next to it. Get your war room T-shirts.
Actually,
welcome to Baltimore, where the battle continues.
That could be quite lucrative, the war room T-shirt, actually.
Including a Martin O'Malley T-shirt and a Martin O'Malley bobblehead.
Zero tolerance.
Yeah. Zero tolerance bobblehead.
Zero tolerance T-shirt and a
bobblehead. Yes.
What do we know about the mayor's new criminal justice director?
Well, I've got to be really honest. I don't know the guy, but he was a chief of staff.
Someone told me that this person is a bit of a journeyman. As far as law enforcement is concerned, I don't know that.
He was chief of staff of the police department, whatever that means. That's what was said in the bio, which I don't know if that means he was Kevin Davis's chief of staff or whether that some other position. But I'd never heard of him. I don't know like anything about him. He's not like someone who is a known, as far as I'm concerned. But that doesn't mean that he's not famous. But
the reason I bring up the journeyman, characterization, I thought that this administration was going to embark upon a national search.
They said they had. If I recall the quote from Mayor Pugh correctly, she said that she had conducted a national search, but what she needed was under her nose all along. I think I have that quote. Oh, I wish you could see the look on
Sean's
face right now.
Yeah, he gets aggravated when we do the police reporting stuff. He just gets more
aggravated.
he just gets more and more consternated, I guess would be the word.
It's an interesting journey.
I think what's interesting about that is that, you know, this position is supposed to be a coordinating position for the entire city that is supposed to coordinate all the different law enforcement agencies. Mm-hmm. And he's coming from the police department. So that means that's kind of going to be his primary connection. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily a skeptical position where you're supposed to be have like civilian control, but he is coming from straight from the police department.
So if he's coming from, as you said, Stephen, if he's coming basically from the police department, we have to wonder how strongly he's going to back the mayor's agenda, if he's going to actually even have the power invested in him to push back. And if he has a desire to do so.
Or, you know, as we've seen the recent body camera footage where there's been controversy over the body camera footage, you know, where the state's attorney, again, is sort of in a little bit of a position, which they should be, of being having oversight of the police department. Will he favor the police department?
Mm-hmm.
And I think the police department has taken a very hostile sort of stance against Marilyn Mosby and her attempt to sort of clean up another mess.
Yes, absolutely. There's no doubt about that.
And I mean, when you have Kevin Davis going in front of the cameras and saying, hey, you know, you can sort of manufacture evidence. And then today we just learned one of the officers in the second body camera incident just came out with his lawyer saying that it wasn't staged and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I wrote a 95 report explaining it, and the state's attorney said they were okay with it. So the police department is really not happy about Marilyn Mosby doing what she should be doing, basically, which is, you know, being the backstop against shoddy investigations.
Right. One of the dozens of suspects who have had their cases dropped because of this video evidence has come forward. I don't know the name of the gentleman, but has come forward to say, I am innocent, as a matter of fact.
That's right.
And again, charges have been dropped against dozens of suspects connected to these two videos.
Well, Sean, I know a lot of times you do point out that there are honest officers, but at this point, institutionally, are we the nadir in the terms of the credibility of the police department? I mean, it just seems to constantly be generating. I mean,
that's fair.
I was listening to NPR last night at 6 o'clock, and there was a story about the body cameras.
Sure. As a matter of fact, Trevor Noah of The Daily Show actually took the time out to call out Baltimore City's police department in a 6-minute long segment. And so we're getting nationally acknowledged.
No, we're getting nationally clowned because he's a comedian, actually.
Yeah. Yes, he's actually.
So he's laughing at us.
And the NPR state, you know, was not what I would call laudatory. Although it was a very balanced report. But, you know, we continue to generate these headlines. And, of course, the outside world looks at us and says, this town is crazy. Mm-hmm. In this town, we have a debate over whether or not what the officers did was correct. Whereas the rest of the world has already decided,
the rest of the world has already been able to
see quite clearly this is not legal. Okay, right. It's not legal. You can't stage evidence. And I read the report from the officer. His lawyer is coming out publicly, which is really bizarre, saying he wrote a 95 report explaining. But, you know, you watch the video in the half-an-hour gap. I mean, what part of the car did he find the evidence finally that he hadn't searched before? And why was it a different officer? Who was the officer on the stakeout?
But why do you think, why does that officer think that somehow he should get the benefit of the doubt in the wake of all that has transpired
that's
over the last 2 years?
Point.
No, I mean,
why on earth would he think that he can turn his camera off for half an hour, pop it back on and be like, ta-da!
Just in time. Yeah. Just in time to find the
magic
evidence.
Trick. Ta-da! Yeah. Here's the evidence that I was looking for.
Instead of being like humble about it, he comes out and says, you guys are all, you know, whatever. I'm not going to use any language. But yes, I think that shows you what we're dealing with. Because you have a city that we clearly know it's not an effective to put all our resources in policing. And then you have a report coming out from the mayor with the first 20 pages. So why wouldn't you think? And then you have a police commissioner, too, that came out and supported him. Why wouldn't you think as an officer you had this power? You know, I really do urge people to watch the video and decide for yourselves. But it is there are a lot of disturbing aspects of it. Not one limited, just the amount of time they just sat there for searching this person's car. So I think, you know, they're just empowered more than any other people in the city.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition. Here on WEAA 88.9, I'm Sean Yost, your host. I'm in the studio with the Mod Squad. That's Taya Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. We're talking politics and law enforcement. Let's take a couple of phone calls real quick. Let's go to Reverend Daki Napata. Reverend Napata, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, and let me apologize. I think the time before the last time I called, I went to sleep, you know, because I stay up day and night. I live at Penn North Plaza. The senior building right next to the CVS. Mm-hmm. I moved here deliberately. I grew up in this community. And it seems at times, you know, we forget the historical context. And having gone to Morgan and other places, now, one thing that was stressed by my teachers was the history. The great Dr. Benjamin Qualls that was there. Mm-hmm. And I have to go on and name the other great people who taught us to be meticulous in our history and in our critical analysis. And one of the things happens when we have a discussion about the police in Baltimore City. One of the glaring things that comes forth is that Dred Scott decision that says a black man has no right and a white man is bound to respect. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is written by Judge Roger Taney, right, a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court from Maryland.
Yes.
You know, and a statue of him is right there beyond Washington Monument in a chair, and that same statue is on the lawn of the governor's mansion in Annapolis, and when you come in to visit it, it's three times as big.
Yes, sir.
I stated to say what? The same thing prevails. That a black man or woman has no right for some officers and some citizenry in some cities that a white man or woman is bound to respect.
Okay.
Because what I've seen, and I'll stop here, is Judge Kenneth Johnson from Alabama, who came to Baltimore as a civil rights attorney. He sued the fire department and the police department to get black people access to the police department to get them hired.
Mm-hmm.
He was approached by black police officers, Black Vanguard, to say, we'd be arresting these white folks from the county, distributing drugs, and the judges let them go. And so he impounded a grand jury. This is not some fiction. And he said, through the grand jury investigation, he came to the ministers. He said, give me a profile for a drug dealer.
All right. Reverend Potter, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Let's go to Brother Leo Burroughs in Bolton Hill. Brother Burroughs, you're on First Edition with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Yes, good evening, Brother Sean Yost. How are you at
Mod
Squad?
I'm all right.
Good evening, Brother Burroughs.
Well, the crime-fighting plan, the mayor's crime-fighting plan, did she receive community organization proposals in shaping that crime plan? It seems to me, if I were mayor, I would want community input in shaping how we fight crime in our community. And also this business of summer jobs, which is all well and good, but is she talking about apprenticeship programs that place people in jobs? And when I say apprenticeship, for those who may not know, we're talking about paid job training programs that have job placement accompanying them. If you, unless you have that kind of program in place, how do we assess the success and failure in with regard to poor people and black men in particular, being accorded their due in a racist society? And of course, I always conclude by saying Kevin Davis must go, because he's the guy who put cameras on police officers, but he comes out with regulations governing their use after they've been placed on police officers. How incompetent is that?
Brother Burroughs, thank you for your time.
I do know the mayor has had these call to action meetings, and she's going to have more where she supposedly is going to be getting input from the community.
Tiffany Ginyard, one of my colleagues and my young protege, had a sit down interview, one on one interview with the mayor, and we talked about it a little bit yesterday. And she talked about those call to action meetings that the mayor has been putting on. And after that interview, I just wanted to put this out to you all. I opened up the phone lines, and one of the things that I said before we started engaging with our listeners was, you know, the mayor inherited some real serious challenges.
Absolutely.
From the previous administration. And I'm clear on that. But at the same time, the people who were calling in, they didn't want to hear that.
Really?
They really didn't.
What was the basic response?
The basic response was that still there have been significant mistakes made in this administration, and a unwillingness, I would say, to look at some of the work, like the call to action meetings and the outreach to grassroots organizations that this administration claims it has done.
Yeah.
I'm in no position necessarily to judge empirically, whether one way or the other, but it just the tone of the listeners was decidedly negative. Yep. I'll just keep it there.
Okay. You know, I would just have to say, I know it is absolutely understandable to hope to see more progress, but we do have to remember what an incredible task that she's been handed. And one thing perhaps she should get credit for is the consent decree was created, and enacted in basically under 60 days. And it's taken other police departments in other cities, you know,
many months
going on years.
She is more personal than her predecessor.
Yes. But
she did show up at the last march from the Shot Tower for the ceasefire weekend.
And we do know that she has spoken with community activists, whereas I don't think her predecessor was known to reaching out to organizers and activists in the community.
Yeah.
So, of course, there is absolutely room for improvement.
And there is a sharp learning curve. I mean, she's been a legislator all her life, and now she's finally an executive sort of administrating a very complex organization.
Yeah, I mean, you looked at the crime plan that she enacted, and there were some good ideas for as Brother Burroughs mentioned.
You just want to put me in the stabilization center, I think, is that what you mean? Let's send people there.
Okay, let's take another phone call. Let's go to Brother Seth, our friend Seth, who has a question about the ceasefire. Seth, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing, Seth?
Hey, Sean. Mod Squad.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, I just had a question for you guys. I haven't really heard you guys, or if you did, I probably missed the show. How do you feel about the ceasefire? Like, how do you feel?
Seth, where you been, bro? You've been on vacation. We've been talking about the ceasefire for weeks, and talked about it yesterday and day before. We talked a lot about it. Ultimately, the ceasefire, I would say, and I suspect my colleagues would agree, was a success in the sense that, talking from a spiritual perspective, raised the vibration of people.
Absolutely.
In the city, there were two homicides during the 72-hour period. But if you look at in totality, it was actually two homicides from Wednesday night to Sunday. We have been averaging about a homicide every 19 and a half hours in the city so far in 2017. So so we obviously mourn the loss of life in our city. Two more young black men killed, but 170 people in one area got their records expunged during the ceasefire weekend, and that is only because of the organizing effort of the ceasefire crew led by Erica Bridgeford and LNG.
Yes.
Yeah. People got their records expunged. People got mental health help. People got
rent and eviction counseling, that kind of stuff. But I think one thing that is really, Tay and I covered a couple of the events, and if anyone's going to raise a consciousness that policing is not the answer and that we need to address those issues, it's going to be the people from the ceasefire like Erica, because they are so on about that and understand that. And the spiritual hearing you're talking about, I'm not, I don't want to sound all misty, but the spiritual part of
it
is
important. The spiritual aspect was profound, and it was tangible. I was there when they were doing a silent meditation and walk, and I got an opportunity to speak in this labyrinth near,
right by the YMCA at 33rd Street.
Right, and it was absolutely beautiful talking to the people, what their personal reasons were for being there, what their goals were, and hoping that they could bring up the vibration in Baltimore to a point where people who had experienced the hurt and pain that would lead to violence in their lives would know that there was an alternative, that there were people who cared, that there were people who were reaching out. And I think it was an incredibly powerful experience, and I do think it's going to have ripple effects.
Be clear, on Friday night, the first full night of the ceasefire, since I've been back in West Baltimore, since I've moved back to West Baltimore, that was the first night of peace that I've had since I moved back. And I'm not joking. I mean, seriously, that is the first night that I had a peaceful night.
Incredible.
On a Friday night in Baltimore.
Yeah, Friday night. Well,
and there's no coincidence. Yeah. That's connected to the work that was done the weeks and actually months leading up to the ceasefire, and people and those organizers, that crew on the ground, engaging young men in particular about that giving them the option, hey, you can do something different, and we can provide services for you that will help you live a better life.
Yeah,
that happened.
Has to happen. I mean, I think Erica has the kind of credibility citywide that very few people have.
There's no doubt.
Maybe like a Tawanda Jones in terms of people will respond to her.
Right.
They will listen to her. And
she
that's
knows
what you
that
need.
She is from the community and is representing the community, and they know that her heart is reaching out to them. She's an incredible woman.
Let me take one more phone call. Let's go to Mike, who has a comment about the mayor's job. Mike, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Fine. How are y'all doing today?
We're doing all right.
Thank you.
Good. Look, no offense. Yeah, she came in with a lot of baggage. Now, I understand that. It's a lot to clean up. But the police commissioner should not be one. These guys were caught on film. Dirty. Plain and simple.
Okay.
Very true.
Plain evidence. They should have been fired on the spot. Let them fight to get their job back. But you need to remind these guys that they are not guards. They have a job. And if they don't do their job right, if they do it corruptly, then they are fired. Get rid of them, let them fight to get their job back. And if they do get their job back, put them in the storehouse or property room somewhere for the rest of their career.
Uh-huh.
That's how that should be.
All right, Mike.
I think I agree 100% with that.
Yeah, accountability Absolutely. Has been a huge issue. I mean, we actually did a story about that for last week's issue about how accountability has been a problem consistently with the police department, that it's very difficult to get a mayor or anybody from City Hall to literally call something for what it is. And we went back to Officer Cossum case, who's the officer who beat the guy on
Colin Truss, yes.
I call him Trance. And, the mayor saw it and wouldn't call for him to be fired. And I think people in the community see that, and they're frustrated.
Do you think some of the reason why it took so long for Mayor Pugh to come out with her crime plan and there have been these sort of bumps in the road, do you think it's because of the office Office of Criminal Justice has been basically, like, their staff's been cut in half. They had a director resign. The director, who's supposed to be the head of their sexual assault response team, had resigned in February. They've been understaffed. I mean, is part of the problem that the Criminal Justice Office doesn't have the people it needs? I mean, just now they hired Drew Vedder and finally put someone, I think someone named Kendra, in charge of the sexual assault response team. I mean, isn't that essential to putting out an effective crime-fighting strategy? Is that part of the problem? I mean, is it, do you think maybe now that there are some people put in place, things are finally going to start moving in the right direction?
I'm all for more bureaucracy, hopefully, when it comes in. You know, I mean, I don't know. I don't think the mayor needs a criminal justice coordinating council to.
So office. That office being understaffed
isn't
really the problem.
I mean, she has tremendous power. She can do whatever she wants, and it's totally within her purview. But I just think that, you know, the institution of policing in Baltimore is so powerful, it's very difficult for a mayor who kind of manages from crisis to crisis to get ahead of an agency like that.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if the new appointee, I think his name is Drew Vedder, the new director of the Office of Criminal Justice, if he really is going to push back against our police commissioner, Davis.
I think our last caller was right.
Perhaps some heads need to roll. Perhaps some people need to pack their things and walk out of the building.
When the consent decree.
The fact that nobody was walking out with boxes in their hands after several
And without pensions.
The Justice Department report should have been the watershed moment. You had walking papers right there. They probably had them in the back, fill up, put the name in. I mean, that report couldn't be more damning, right?
Right.
Yeah. The Mod Squad is Taya Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. Friends, thank you for your time,
as always.
We'll see you Friday.
See you Friday.
All right.
Absolutely.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the second hour, first edition, holistic education in the holistic living segment with Kenyatta Moon. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition.